Hi, and welcome to Power of 10, a podcast about design operating at many levels, zooming out from thoughtful detail through to organizational transformation and on to changes in society and the world. My name is Andy Pollane. I'm a design leadership coach, service design and innovation consultant, educator and writer. My guest today is Alison Coward, a strategist, workshop facilitator, coach, trainer, keynote speaker and author with 20 years experience in leading and facilitating creative teams. She is sought after by top-tier clients such as Google, Euronext, Barclaycard, the Wellcome Trust, and Channel 4. I first came across Alison several years ago through her book, A Pocket Guide to Effective Workshops, published by Five Simple Steps. And she just recently published her new book, Workshop Culture, A Guide to Building Teams That Thrive, which we're going to talk about today, amongst other things. Alison, welcome to Power of 10.
Thank you for having me.
So you've got one of those comma-separated careers like I have with lots of different things. Tell us a little bit about your journey from where you've been to where you are now.
That question is like, where do I start? So I think I'll probably start from just before I set up Bracket. And before I set up Bracket, I was working in, it was a sector that was kind of, in the UK, we had all this funding that was poured into developing the creative industries. And I worked for organisations that provided support to creative businesses, self-employed creative freelancers.
Yeah.
I was really passionate about how to help their businesses flourish. Worked for a few organisations, like publicly funded organisations. And then I started working at the Enterprise Centre at the University for the Arts London. Just before I joined the University of the Arts London, working there, I actually did an MA in Enterprise and Management for the Creative Arts. And that was really because I was, you know, so passionate about supporting creative businesses. I wanted to really have some theory behind the support that they needed and how organisations like the ones that I worked for could provide effective mechanisms to really help their businesses to grow. During my MA, sounds funny to say that I stumbled across the concept of collaboration. Well, not the concept of collaboration, but all of the content, the research that I was reading pointed to collaboration as such a key aspect of the creative industries in businesses growing and developing, and this whole idea of networks. And so my whole MA was really exploring what does it look like to provide some kind of platform that brings creative practitioners together, not just to network, but to actively work on projects together and produce stuff together. So these kind of freelancers that often create their own work independently, what would it be like to bring them together into teams? And that was actually the first iteration of Bracket, bringing independent freelancers together into projects. And as part of that, because I was kind of like the producer type, I took the producer type role. When I brought freelancers together, I wasn't a content creator. I was the person that facilitated those teams. I kind of saw my role as the person that would, first of all, make sure that the team was set up in a way that brought the most diverse skills together that was needed for that project, but then also created the environment for those individuals that had never met before to collaborate effectively to kick off the project and throughout a project. And that's kind of when I stumbled across the idea of facilitation.
So, you know, in the creative arts, which is the kind of milieu, I guess, were these freelancers in that sort of realm for starters? I guess I'm making assumptions based on the MA you did, but were they in the creative arts or was it in kind of other areas?
It was varied, actually. So I worked for an organisation that supported, we called them designer makers at the time. So these were like furniture designers and home furnishing designers, the types of designers that you might see at the Milan Furniture Fair, that kind of thing.
Yeah, okay.
And then when I started working at the University of the Arts, that was really varied because it was really all of the disciplines that were studied at the University of the Arts, which ranged from kind of ceramics and jewellery all the way through to fine art, photography, film, media.
Yeah.
And the creative industries have got a really high proportion of individuals that are self-employed. So the centre that I worked for was all around helping students and graduates develop the skills that they needed to set up as freelancers.
And the reason why I was asking was where I was going with that question originally is I studied film and video and photography and this new thing, digital thing, back in the early 90s. And the filmmaking thing, which is actually what I wanted to be, was a thing that's really stuck with me as a sort of model for collaboration, a multidisciplinary collaboration. So I guess when I think of the performing arts in particular, you know, whether that's film, TV, theatre, music, you know, there is kind of collaboration baked in. And I'm interested to know whether that was, you know, new to you or new to them, or whether actually when you kind of were taking this facilitator role, you know, this is a role that hadn't been there before for these people.
Yeah, interesting. I guess it was, in a sense, new to me, because it felt like I kind of discovered how important it was when I was doing my MA and I was reading all of these books by like Charles Leadbetter and Daniel Pink and Teresa Marbile, all sort of looking at this, sort of the field of creativity and how kind of networks and collaboration were really key to that. John Hawkins, those kinds of things all come back to me now. And the project teams that I set up, they were, I mean, we didn't really do anything within the performing arts. It was more kind of marketing-led projects. So I was bringing together, say, an animator together with a graphic designer, together with a copywriter who would, their roles, you know, the way that they ran their businesses was to either create their own content and sell it, or they would work as freelancers. So this whole idea of kind of coming together into a team from scratch wasn't something that they would do. They might do that when working with an agency, but not sort of independent of an agency in a sense. It's almost like we were building like these mini kind of enterprises, temporary enterprises.
Yeah, I mean, that's the model from film that I really like too, which is this idea. Yeah. I've just been watching and sort of vicariously living out my unlived life and career. There's a series on Disney Plus about Industrial Light and Magic. You know, the people who do the visual effects, they were put together for Star Wars and then, you know, gradually increased their work. But there's always been this model in film and I think TV production as well, where there's like a core production company that might have a skeleton crew of sort of small amount of people. And then it balloons, and often there's an actual, you know, legally there's a different company set up for that particular film. And, you know, that's how all the kind of payroll is managed. But all those people come together and then, you know, it morphs depending on what stage of production it's at. And then it kind of, you know, dissipates again, and then they all come together again, sometimes a different constellation each time. And I've really liked that as a model.
Definitely.
And I'm wondering, I'm jumping ahead actually, but I'm wondering about, you know, one of the things that's quite nice about that is this idea of there's a kind of, there's very clear discipline, more or less discipline boundaries. And when you just talked about, you know, an animator and an illustrator and things like that, but also there's a very clear kind of production structure and an approach. But also it's kind of time boxed, right? And your book is kind of more about an ongoing thing and culture. And I'm wondering if you see there's some advantages to this idea of like, we're going to be working intensively together for, could be as little as a few weeks, could be several months, but then that's kind of over. And the idea of kind of reconstellation is a good thing, or whether you feel like, you know, but teams and creating a culture that's ongoing for, say, many years is really the thing to strive for, or if I'm sort of making a straw man there.
But I think it's both. Firstly, I want to say that the model that you referred to in the film sector, it is called the Hollywood model. It was kind of something that was, you know, when I was doing my MA, it was spoken about quite a lot. I think it was Charles Handy that spoke about this kind of hub and spoke model that you mentioned. So there was this kind of conversation around how can the Hollywood model be used in other sectors? So I think that's probably one of the things that largely inspired me. In terms of the temporary collaborative team, as opposed to the ongoing team that needs to develop their culture, it's really interesting because when I had set up this agency and I was doing, you know, I took on the role of facilitator without realizing really that's what I was doing. It was actually companies that came to me after observing what I was doing in the room with this temporary team of freelancers and saying, what you're doing there, we could do with that in our team. So I didn't actually know that the tools and the techniques that I was using with these temporary teams would actually be of use to organizations. And I kind of made that transition, actually. I saw that there was an opportunity there. And it has been really organic because, as I say, at the start there, I didn't know that this was something that organisations needed or wanted. And all of the facilitation that I was doing for these temporary teams was in light of a team that would somehow at some point disband. And so it has been a very different journey, because when you go into an organisation, there's the history of teams, there's the system that the team exists within in the organisation. There's a lot more to do with, you know, personality clashes and emotions that come up that doesn't really come up in a temporary team, because the freelancers are kind of in, they want to get the job done, they want to do it well because it's important for their portfolio. So they often don't really kind of, you know, there's very little, I guess, politics drama that might exist in those temporary teams. And so my journey really as a facilitator has been learning all of that and understanding, you know, the differences and nuances that apply and exist when looking at team culture.
So your first book was sort of very practical, you know, this is how you do workshops, or effective workshops. And this book is workshop culture is, I guess, is that transition you just described. Why did you write it? And what's the kind of fundamental thesis, would you say, of it?
Yeah, so the fundamental thesis, I'll start with that. The fundamental thesis is that what happens in workshops, in really well-facilitated workshops, collaboration, creativity, a team that's engaged, great conversations, you know, great ideas, is great. And we want that in workshops. And it's also what we need in our organisations on an ongoing basis. Mm. So we shouldn't leave that magic to a time-boxed event, which is a workshop. There is value in having time-boxed events to focus, and we don't want to, at the minute that that time-boxed event finishes, we don't just want to go back to how things were before, because those are the things that we want in our everyday culture. Through my experience of running workshops, I started, you know, from the very original iteration of Bracket, which was this virtual agency, if you like, transitioning into what I call workshop facilitation for teams. And it wasn't, you know, the workshop facilitation that I did wasn't necessarily team culture focused. It was anytime a team needed to get together and needed a facilitator to help manage that discussion, whether it was developing their plan for the year or generating ideas around a new product that they wanted to deliver, or it could have been aspects of working together, I would go in and deliver these one-off sessions. I had some opportunities to work with clients at this time over a period of time, and I started to see the impact that running a range of workshops had, not only on how the participants, the people in the company turned up to each individual workshops, but what was happening in between those workshops. And I kind of thought to myself, there's something more here than just running a great facilitated workshop. There's something else to this. And that's where I really started to do a deep dive into this idea of what I coined workshop culture, which is the impact that workshops can have on a team, how a team works together overall.
So this is the kind of repeated nature of it, is where you saw the difference. I mean, there's a little bit of kind of both, I guess. There's also, you know, what if we could do this all the time? Seems to be kind of part of the thinking behind it.
Yes and no. So the yes is, yes, we should be bringing more principles of workshops into our everyday. So, you know, a big part of the book that I talk about is the fact that meetings are broken, and we could fix elements of meetings if we take inspiration from workshops and use some of the techniques and the tools that facilitators use to make meetings more effective. At the same time, we know as facilitators that actually running workshops and participating in workshops can be quite exhausting. We can't work like that all the time. So then how can we take some of the principles of workshops without the need to almost like a continuous workshop, I guess? You know, we do need downtime, we do need time on our own, but how can we take principles of it? And, you know, it might be how we set up, how we work asynchronously. Mm. Like, what is it that facilitators do in workshops to support communication that we could take and learn from when we're working apart to make sure that we're all aligned and in the same page? But what can we take from workshops to influence the one-to-one conversations that we have? What can we take from workshops in designing an overall process for a team throughout a project? You know, a workshop is designed, And we look at the, you know, the dynamics that might be at play. We look at the outcomes that we want to get from the workshop, and we design, you know, we design a process. Facilitators are process designers, essentially, aren't they?
Yeah.
And so what if we took a step back and said, okay, the process that we're designing is this 3-month project. And where are the times when we come together? When are the times we need to be apart? What are the tools that we need to support communication throughout?
Yeah, there's an intentionality to that, right? I guess there is, I think what you're saying around, you know, I, like you, have had that experience of I've facilitated a workshop and everyone's, oh, that's amazing. And then, you know, let's go back to our boring jobs and the way we do this, and it's all kind of rubbish. And you know, we know, yeah, well, it was all, and workshops get a bad name, I think, because that was all kind of lots of hot air and sticky notes. And now we have to kind of go back to the reality of the fact that, you know, everyone is fighting over stuff and we have to use these crappy tools and all the rest of it. So there's an intentionality to the way we work and the way we have conversations with each other and where and when we have those, that I think you automatically do, if you're going to do a workshop well, you automatically go through, you know, what's the intent of this? What's the outcomes we're after? Are there any outputs that we're after? You know, what's the cadence of it? You know, is this, what are the kind of divergent, convergent sort of flows of those things? All of those things we kind of think about in a workshop. And then sort of go on autopilot when it comes back to daily work and, well, let's have a meeting or let's have a recurring. My most hated thing are recurring meetings, actually. You know, we've got a senior leadership, you know, meeting every Monday or whatever. And it's just kind of really is autopilot, that stuff.
Yeah. So what you described is 100% it, yeah. You know, the yeah. intentionality of it. And there's also something in terms of how the people, including the leader and the team, show up and interact with each other. And what are the qualities of a facilitator? You know, off the top of my head, a facilitator is curious, they ask questions, and they're good at synthesis. They kind of, you know, generate ideas before, or, you know, facilitate the process of generating ideas before finalizing a solution. And, you know, turning up as a team member with that mindset and that attitude also has an impact on the way. So there is the design of the process, but there's also the kind of mindset and the behaviours that you would try to, you know, you display in a workshop, both as a facilitator and a participant, that would make for an ideal collaborative working environment for a team on an ongoing basis.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that, well, that intentionality also is about purpose, right? We know why we're mm-hmm. here, as opposed to that recurring meeting where no one really knows why they're there. And you talk about purpose quite a lot at the beginning of the book. Can you tell us, you know, everyone might think, well, of course, purpose matters, Andy. Why are you even asking the question? But tell us why it matters.
So in the book, I share a 5-pillar framework that we use in my company, Bracket, for high-performing teams. And the first pillar is alignment. And I mean, I've been influenced by a lot of great thinkers in developing that framework, and one of them that comes to mind is Daniel Pink and the model that he presents in Drive: autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And for me, having a clear purpose as a team, you know, it's about alignment, it's about making sure that everyone's clear, we're all pointing in the same direction, but it's also about having, I guess, a purpose at a micro level when you hit roadblocks and barriers and conflict. At the micro level, you know, we've all been engaged in conflict and, you know, difficult conversations and arguments with our team members, relatives, friends. And having a clear purpose enables you sometimes to kind of step out of that, take a bit more of an objective view. At the micro level, it can seem quite painful, and it can seem like this is a really big issue when you're in some kind of, you know, you're locking horns with somebody. But if you're both clear on what it is that you're trying to get to, then it's like, do you know what? It's not us against each other. It's us working together to get to that end goal. And this is just a blip on that road.
This is what I like about that kind of film and TV and actually kind of music as well model, is that there's usually, you know, we all know we're making a film. We can argue a lot about what it should be. And, you know, even if it's a comedy or a horror movie or whatever, but certainly how it kind of looks and feels and everything else. But we all kind of know that that's the purpose of why we're here. We're not the, you know, we're not unsure about that. And I think that really helps to have that kind of big end goal. But I also think it helps, and as I've just been writing about this for my book, and I had that kind of crossover moment, you know, it's the number one reason why people leave companies and hate their jobs, and it's a lack of purpose, right? You can be doing, I don't say bad work, but you can be doing work that you perhaps don't feel particularly thrilled by, but know it has a kind of purpose and know, you know, at least why you're doing it. I think that's easier to put up with than the other way around, where you're kind of might be doing fantastic work, but you're not really sure whether it's going to go anywhere.
Exactly.
Or it doesn't seem like, why am I doing this? That seems to eat people up much more than the other way around.
I think there's actually some research. I don't know which of my books. I think it might be a Dan Ariely book, where he talks about a research study where they were looking at students that were trying to get donations for a fund. And the students that knew exactly who or an individual that they were trying to raise those funds for did better than the ones that were just trying to collect funds.
Yeah. There's a thing I wrote a kind of note about balance, and there's a couple of kind of things in there, which was the first one's about this sort of balance between productive conflict and psychological safety. Because we talk about, or you talk about that, and you know, if you're facilitating or even if you're leading a team, one of the things you try and create is that psychological safety, because that's where, I guess, where productive conflict can happen, right? You need to know that I can critique your work without you taking it kind of personally or taking it out on me personally. But I also need to know that you're not going to do personally attack me. So can you talk about that sort of balance? Because you talk about productive conflict, and I think it's a thing that's often avoided, conflict just in general. I might go so far, I know other people have gone so far to say there's a bit of a generational thing that's gone on there about, you know, a sort of allergy to conflict or even witnessing conflict. But there is obviously kind of balance between, so there's like a relationship between the two. And I wonder what your view is on getting that balance right.
I just want to talk to the balance piece, because I think this is probably one of the biggest, actually maybe not one of the biggest, a big challenge that our modern leaders have in constantly having to search for balance. And it's almost like, you know, I really recognise this as I was writing the book, and I recognise it with a lot of the clients that I work with, in that we are sometimes pushed towards an either-or situation. It's either psychological safety or you have productive conflict, when actually most things are on a continuum. And I find that the job of the leader is to like move up and down that continuum, like know when you need a bit of, it's almost like having a mixer, you know, like a sound mixer. And you've got all these kind of factors, and you know, the leader is kind of constantly trying to find, you never find the perfect balance. There's never going to be a point when everything's lined up, but you're kind of, you know, sort of dialing up and dialing down depending on what the team needs at that particular time. So I do talk about balance a lot. If I don't mention the word balance in the book, then I definitely allude to it a lot. I think I've got a diagram which is kind of balancing people in business and doing and thinking, and this idea about balancing creativity and productivity as well. And I think the idea around the productive conflict is really important. I mean, I wonder whether it's less of a balance and just more of knowing when a team is experiencing conflict or when individuals are experiencing conflict with each other, being able to identify whether that conflict is productive or not. Because there are different types of conflict there. And, you know, contradicting what I said, on a binary level, there is destructive conflict and there's productive conflict. Destructive conflict is when people have the personality clashes and, you know, it gets very, very personal. Productive conflict is around ideas and tasks. It's kind of separate from the individual. And what a leader wants within their team, or what a team wants, is to have the majority of conflict sitting in productive conflict rather than in the destructive conflict. I mean, you almost want to avoid, or try to find ways of avoiding, destructive conflict at all costs, because that's where the psychological safety breaks down. And there can be very high psychological safety in productive conflict when it doesn't get personal.
Yeah, although, I mean, I think that one of the challenges in design work is there is a certain amount of kind of pulling something out of you, in a, or, you know, I say design work, in anything creative, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, you're pulling out of you a, you know, Jonny Ive talks about this a lot, these kind of very fragile kind of seeds and shoots of an idea at the beginning. And it's like, oh, what about this kind of half-baked thing? And you really need to have the safety to feel like I can kind of put this thing out there and you're not, you're going to recognize that this is a kind of fragile thing and not just kind of stamp all over it immediately. At the same time, you know, that's a thing that comes out of the person and you do need to be able to talk about it. And, you know, the yes, there's the whole kind of yes and thing and stuff. But sometimes you actually do want to kind of really, you know, one of the things that gets frustrated at the moment, that's a little bit of a sort of bugbear at the moment, is that I think people move from a kind of half-baked idea to a, you know, a working mock-up or even a kind of design, because the tools allow it really easily, much, much quicker than they ever used to. And there's a, whatever you might think of Chris Sacker as a kind of VC guy, there's a really good blog post he wrote called An Email I'll Never Open. And there's a thing in it where he says, you know, too many of you are moving from idea to kind of production because the barriers of that are so low now, without really going through the process where loads of people beat the shit out of an idea before you take it forward. And I think that's, yeah, that bit is really, really important. And I feel like sometimes I'm not at all advocating for toxic environments. I'm going to really kind of advocate against that all the time. But there is something there where I've seen people use psychological safety as a way of saying, I don't want to hear criticism. And that's kind of a different thing, right?
Yeah, that's not psychological safety. That psychological safety is the ability to be able to speak up and be honest without fear of, you know, being ridiculed.
Yeah.
And so there are a few things around what you said there that I want to point to. One point is around making the space for that criticism.
Yeah.
Often, you know, these ideas are half-baked and we sometimes don't have the right tools or the right approach to feed back on those ideas when they're half-baked. So I talk a lot. I mean, I honestly believe that there's one sort of, you know, tool that we can use in our conversations and our meetings that would instantly make a massive difference. And it's so simple that it's probably too simple for people to believe it, but it is that separation of divergent and convergent thinking. The divergent thinking is the half-baked ideas. It's like, you know, I'm just sharing this. We're just exploring ideas. And at this stage, we're protecting those half-baked ideas from criticism. And because it is, you know, providing the environment for people to feel that they can speak up and say the ideas that don't feel fully formed, or they might even be stupid ideas, or, you know, in their heads, they feel that they're stupid ideas. But you need that psychological safety. You need to protect that time. And so that people do feel free to speak, but be very clear that we can't stay in that stage. We do have to move to a phase of critique, which is the convergent thinking. And we also need to know how to manage those conversations in convergent thinking. It's not kind of a free for all and kind of making, you know, going for the jugular and not being careful around our words. I mean, another issue that we have, which is kind of so widespread, and it's so interesting that, you know, I feel that this is something that I've become more aware of as I've got deeper into my knowledge and expertise around team culture, is that we are not naturally good at giving constructive feedback, and we're not naturally good at taking constructive feedback. Both sides are difficult. And there's a really great film that I watched, which was, it's one of those, it's funny, but it's also painful funny, you know, like the whole kind of Curb Your Enthusiasm type, yeah, painful, where you're just cringing the whole way through. It's called You Hurt My Feelings. And it's about a writer who actually, I mean, the central character is a writer, but it's actually about all the characters, about how difficult it is to give honest feedback to your loved ones because you don't want to hurt their feelings. And also what it feels like to have really kind of straight, blunt feedback when someone really doesn't care about hurting your feelings. And just that whole conversation about how awkward it is on all sides. And it just really highlighted for me that we naturally do kind of shy away. We're either too straightforward without kind of thinking about how that's going to impact the other person, or we shy away from giving straight feedback because we think they're going to hurt the other person's feelings. But at the same time, no matter how well crafted our feedback is, it's always going to sting when you receive it. I don't think there's anybody that can honestly say that they get feedback and they don't think like that initial moment when they sort of have some kind of criticism, regardless of how well it's delivered, that you don't think, ouch. You know, you might sort of become a little bit more immune to it, but it does always sting. So I think we need to get better at giving and receiving feedback.
Yeah, I agree. I think when you get to know, when you've worked with someone, that is one of those things where you've worked with someone for a long time and there's a spoken or unspoken sense of respect for each other and love for each other, actually, if you've worked with each other for a long time, where you can kind of get over that, where you know that's a sort of given, and so it doesn't sting in the same way because you know it's not really about you. But I agree. There's a kind of paradox there I've found, which is this thing I've often said, which kind of rules set you free. And it comes in, my PhD was about sort of interactivity and play. And one of the things in play and in games is you have rules in order to enjoy the game, right? And if you break the rules in a game, you actually kind of ruin the game. You ruin the enjoyment of the game quite often, unless that's what the game is how you kind of sneak by the rules. And I think there's a very true thing in sort of feedback culture as well, which is, as you kind of pointed out, it's a thing that you have to learn and sometimes structure. And I think I see a lot of leaders go, oh, my teams aren't really kind of critically thinking enough and they're not really, you know, in feedback sessions that it's not really going deeply. And I often ask whether they've sort of intentionally structured that or not, or whether it's more like a kind of showcase with, hey, everyone, come and show us your latest work.
Right.
And in that, you don't set up the kind of permission space, right? In the sort of whole play and game kind of theory, there's this idea of the magic circle that's by this guy Heusinger from some time ago came up with this. But, you know, if you think in a boxing ring, you're allowed to hit someone in the face. You're not allowed to hit them beneath the belt. Or in rugby, you know, you're not allowed to, you know, kick the ball. Or in football, you can't, you know, use your hands. So there's kind of things like that where actually, you know, once you set that up, everyone knows, okay, these are the rules here. And I think it's a kind of, it sets you free because everyone knows that, well, I'm saying this because that's the rules of the game.
Yeah, 100%.
And this is allowed in this space, but not in this other space, right, outside of that.
Absolutely. So it's exactly the sort of, you know, the divergent, creating the space for divergent thinking. Yeah. It's like, okay, the next 15 minutes we're generating ideas. We are not allowed to critique the ideas. It's just we share freely, we share openly, we share what's on our mind, and then being clear that when we move into the constructive criticism phase of the convergent thinking, that, you know, again, putting the guardrails around that, we feedback on the idea, not the person. Your idea is stupid, not you are stupid, you know? Which I'm not sure makes any difference.
Yeah, and it's weird because people know that from brainstorming, right? A lot of people know the rules of brainstorming, if you like, but not the other end of it.
Exactly. And there's tools out there for that. There's like Edward de Bono's six thinking hats where you have a different color for a different way that you give feedback or you assess ideas, or you can agree as a team on a set of quality criteria. It's like, okay, let's generate lots of ideas, or even before you generate the ideas. Mm. Not before you generate the ideas, because that might lead, but after generating the ideas, what are the criteria? What is it that would make a good idea for us? Mm. Now let's assess all of the ideas that we generated against that set of criteria.
Yeah, rather than just kind of voting with a dot.
Exactly.
Yeah. A rose thorn bud is nice, you know, because there's a feedback structure. But I think the nicest bit about it is one of the rules is you take, so for those who don't know, roses are the good people think, the things that people think are good. Thorns are the things that people think aren't very good. And buds are the things that have potential. And a lot of those get sort of inverted, like, you know, here's a thing that could be better, but I don't think it is. Or whatever, and people get a bit muddled up with it. But one of the rules, at least the way I learned it, was when you're the feedback receiver, you just stay silent and you say thank you at the end, and that's it. There's no kind of justification going on halfway through. And I think that's a really important thing too.
Yeah.
You have this framework. You have these five pillars. Tell us what they are.
So the five pillars are alignment, cohesion, communication, design, and change. And the idea is that it's not a step-by-step process. It's almost like sort of having an awareness of to what extent each of those are present within your team, but it does give you an indication of kind of where you need to start. You know, if you have a team that is experiencing lots of conflict and there's low productivity, you can't skip past the alignment and the cohesion pillar. You have to do those. And the more sort of high performing teams that I tend to come across, it's not that we don't have to focus on the alignment cohesion pillar, but we can kind of go through those you know, a lot more rapidly. So alignment is, are we all on the same page? Are we all pointing in the same direction? Are we clear on our vision? Have we developed values that we agree that we're working towards? All of those kinds of things around, you know, what do we need to do as a team and how do we need to be as a team to make it happen? Cohesion is around individual working styles and kind of just developing those connections in the team. You know, one of the biggest sources of conflict in a team, not research backed, but from my observations, is different working styles and people not being able to see things from other perspectives. So you might have someone who is like really great at ideas development, but they can be a sort of a little bit fluffy around getting things done and meeting deadlines. And you've got sort of the kind of the producer type person. You've got the producer type person who's really good at hitting deadlines. And, you know, they may clash. They may clash, but the cohesion pillar is about helping people to understand that there's different ways of approaching work and that actually those different ways of approaching work are valuable within a team. The communication pillar is just that, how a team interacts, what are the kinds of conversations that a team needs to have to stay on track and up to date, and how are they going to have those conversations? So largely in the way that, not exclusively, but largely how teams meet and have meetings and how those meetings are run. And design is around ways of working. So is there anything additional to meetings that could be designed, like you mentioned, intentionally to support connection, collaboration, rituals, routines, systems, processes that can bake in the way that a team needs to be into the way that they work and kind of support that? You know, rituals and routines can really support the values that a team has created through kind of, you know, developing a process that reflects those values. And then change is all around continuous improvement. So this, again, this idea that this is not a one and done thing. We need to be working and discussing and having conversations around our team culture on a continuous basis, because things change, and even more rapidly now. You know, what worked 6 months ago, you may need to take a stop. I mean, I know we spoke about at the beginning about sort of continuous team culture as opposed to temporary teams. Actually, I'm kind of seeing a little bit more of these sort of the elements of temporary teams coming into teams that are working together on an ongoing basis, because things are changing, whether that is, you know, the team structure changes, the team makeup changes, there's new conditions on the way that they work, or there's new requirements of them. And all of that requires a recontracting of the culture. Is the culture that we are working to, or the way that we work, is it relevant for the context that we're sitting within now? And so that's the change pillar, sort of around having those conversations and staying accountable and just keeping it all top of mind, basically.
Yeah. So, you, I mean, you've talked about them as pillars, but your diagram is a wheel, actually, isn't it? It's a kind of like segments. And so that idea, I guess, of, you know, you can come in at any point on that wheel and sort of go around. And you said you've got a tool, haven't you? You've got like an assessment thing on the workshopculture.co.uk.
Yes, yeah.
We are coming close to time.
We'll talk another hour again.
One of the things that's always interesting, I think, when you've finished a book, you know, I think when I first got in touch with you, I said, oh, you know, congratulations. You've just come to the end of life. I've just submitted the final manuscript, or the first draft, I think, even. And then there's lots of kind of what I call sweeping up of the bits and pieces. Loads of stuff to be done once you've actually written a book, you know, at the end of it. But then there's this other thing of, you know, it's published, it goes out in the world. And quite often by that point, you've got new thoughts. You know, sometimes they're the germ of a new book that might come, or whatever else. Is there anything sort of, having done it and having sort of seen some reaction to it and sort of put it out in the world, that you kind of think, you know, actually there's a thing now, I mean, you just mentioned one, but there's a thing now that, or some stuff that I would add, or is it too fresh still?
It's probably too fresh, but I smile because I just did a workshop last week and I took the team through some of the elements of workshop culture. And I had a really lovely comment from someone after the workshop who said that the workshop was great. And actually, I was applying some of that to my own life as well. Like, some of the questions you're asking, I could apply to my own life. And I thought, oh, is that the next book? Which, I've done effective workshops, I've got workshop culture. Is there a book which is workshop your life?
I think there may, I mean, maybe. I mean, I you're a coach, I'm a coach. There's a lot of, and I use a lot of these tools in my own coaching, and I approach coaching kind of as a design process, and, you know, let's do the you know, let's do the initial sort of data collection and reflection and get something. Then what are the patterns that emerge and the synthesis on that? And then, you know, how might we? So there's a lot of kind of stuff that I think you can take through into your work.
Definitely. I also think those five pillars could, you know, I mean, they're not rocket science, but I don't think they're rocket science. It's kind of me pulling together everything that I know about team culture and making it a bit more digestible. But I also think that those five pillars could apply to personal relationships, right?
You yes.
know,
yeah.
Are we kind of, do we want the same things out of, you know, our relationship? Are we really appreciating what we're yeah. individually bringing into this relationship? Yeah. All the, you know, are we reviewing, yeah, how we're interacting?
But, I mean, by which you mean sort of one-to-one sort of couple relationships, yeah. Because I was
yeah.
going to otherwise sort of push back, because
yeah,
I think
yeah.
one of the, you know, the big lies in the world is this idea that it's not personal, it's just business, that our relationships with people at work are somehow not a kind of personal thing.
I yeah. can't stand that phrase. I'm literally want to write a blog post about that, because
yeah,
I cannot stand that phrase. It is, of course,
yeah.
personal, you know, because we're people. I just, you know, I think that phrase yeah. should be eradicated from...
I mean, I've seen people yeah. in consulting, particularly management consulting, and I've seen them treat either, you know, people they work with or who work for them, but also clients and speak to them in ways. I kind of just sat there thinking, you would never speak to even a stranger like that, let alone a friend or someone you know, or an
yeah.
acquaintance. And, you know, how is that excusable that you kind of, you interact with a human being in that way? And it's always kind of covered in that, or masked in that idea of like, well, it's, you know, of course it's just business, but it can be a real excuse mm-hmm. for terrible behavior. And one of the things I think I realized as a design leader was this thing of, you know, after about 5 years of experience, most designers know how to design, and they don't really kind of get stuck very often on design stuff and then need kind of daddy design director to come and do stuff. The opposite, if anything, but it's all people stuff. It was always this stakeholder's difficult. We're having a problem with this person in the team, or, you know, that person in the team saying the rest of the team are the problem, and all of that kind of stuff. It was all people stuff. I mean, like 98% of it was people stuff, and not the kind of we're struggling with this idea or what to do with it, you know. Or, I mean, most of the noise is people stuff.
Yeah, and you know, I think this is one of. I kind of talk about this at the end of the book a bit more, but and maybe this is the next book. But I honestly believe, you know, we spend a lot, particularly in the knowledge economy, we spend a lot of our time at work.
Mm.
We put a lot of energy into our work. And like you say, 98% of the challenges that we face are people focused. So if we can improve the way that we have the tools and the awareness and the skills to improve the way that we interact with other people, and we even brought that percentage down to 70%. Imagine the impact that would have on our experience of work, and therefore then our experience of life, because we spend so much time at work. And so this is one of the reasons for me writing Workshop Culture. So I do, you know, I have the privilege to be trusted by so many teams and going in and seeing some of those, you know, I work with some brilliant teams that are great. And I also see some tricky situations as well. And, you know, from an outsider, from an objective point of view, sometimes you kind of see people are so, you know, when you're in the state of conflict, you're so intertwined in it that you can't take a step back and sort of question whether this is necessary.
Yeah.
Whereas from someone on the outside, you can kind of say, you know, your life would just be so much easier if you just took a step back and, you know, thought about this in a different way or thought about repairing that relationship. I know it sounds easy and simplistic, but
yeah.
This is one of sort of my reasons for writing this book. It is to kind of look at work. For some people, work is that.
Mm.
Work is the challenging relationships they have with people, and that's all work is for them. It is difficult. It's not enjoyable. Or everyone else that they work with is the problem. And for me, work doesn't need to be and shouldn't be like that. We should be solving big problems together. We should be putting our energy into solving the big problems rather than trying to figure out how we, you know, solve the conflicts that we have.
Yeah.
Some of which are very unnecessary. Yeah.
There's a blog post I wrote a while ago, and I use it quite a lot, and it's this idea of that leadership is sort of slow motion facilitation, like you're doing it over kind of very long period of time. The similar things that you're, you know, really what your book is about, actually, of applying what you know from running a workshop over sort of what might be a couple of hours, half a day in, you know, over a kind of longer period of time. But there's a thing you've just kind of touched upon there, which, and you said it right at the beginning, so it's a nice way to maybe kind of round it up, which is, you know, people approach being a workshop participant. They bring a different kind of self to that than they do their kind of everyday life. So maybe there's something there about sort of developing a workshop mindset or something that, you know, that you come to your work with that's different from this, what I would say is more like the kind of factory mindset of, or an industrial mindset of, you know, I'm just kind of there to do my widgets. And, you know, those people who get in the way of me making my widgets need to kind of, you know, get out of my way. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, look, the final question is always, the power of 10 is named after the Eames film, Powers of 10. It's all about the relative size of things in the universe. And so the final question is always, you know, what one small thing is either overlooked or should be redesigned that would have an outsized effect on the world?
Gosh, I mean, I was thinking about this question before, and I don't think I've really come to a clear answer, but I think something along the lines of what we were discussing, is there something that we could design that could help people build more empathy for each other? Mm. It's the relationship thing. Like we often think about design in terms of, you know, things and, you know, products, even services, but I wonder what could be design or how could we use design in our relationships to help people get on more effectively with each other.
I think you've just written a book about that, haven't you?
Yeah.
So yeah. Where can people find you online?
So my website, business website, is bracketcreative.co.uk. And I'm Alison Coward in most other places. LinkedIn is probably where you find me hanging out the most. The book site is workshopculture.co.uk. The book is called Workshop Culture, A Guide to Building Teams That Thrive. And it's available from online from most good bookstores.
Wherever you get your books. Alison, thank you so much for being my guest on Power of 10.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.
You've been listening to me, Andy Pullane, on Power of 10. You can find me at apullane on pkm.social, on Mastodon, apullane on Twitter, or go to pullane.com where you can find more episodes, check out my coaching practice and online courses, as well as sign up for my newsletter, Doctor's Note. If you enjoyed the show, please take a moment to give it a rating on iTunes. As you know, it tickles the algorithms and helps more people find the podcast. As always, get in touch if you have any comments, feedback, or suggestions for guests. All the links are in the show notes. Thanks for listening and see you next time. We'll